Okay. My name's Bob. I'm a sober alcoholic. I want to thank the committee, Aaron, and all the people that's put this together. I'm sure it's a lot of hard work. Also, I want to thank Dolly for calling me, and also for Harner for a lot of hard work he does. And I know a lot of other people that are behind the scenes that have done a lot of work. I'd like to read something to start with. Being that I'm down on the menu as the main speaker, when I was down there at 16, I was the first guy to come out. And I liked that because it was all the other people that followed were a lot better than I spoke. Just like today. There's a lot of speakers today. I want to thank all of them for what they had to offer, and I really enjoyed every one of them. But I'd like to read this to start with. It's out of the 24-hour book, and it's October the 2nd. It said, what makes an effective talk at an AA meeting? It's not the fine speech with fine choice of words and the impressive delivery. Often a few simple words direct from the heart are more effective than the most polished speech. There is always a temptation to speak beyond your own experience in order to make a good impression. This never is effective. What does not come from the heart does not reach the heart. What comes from personal experience and sincere desire to help the other person to reach the heart. And I truly believe that. I want to put some disclaimers out there. I'm not the best guy that you could probably have tonight. I'm sure there's a lot of other people out there that spoke even. They're a lot better speakers than I am. But when I'm asked, I try to do what I'm asked. One of the things that I want to say that my sobriety date is 11/7/1969. That's not the first time that I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I came in June of 1949 was my first meeting. And I've had a long ride, almost 51 years. And the thing that I would like to tell is some stories. My lead is basically stories, and I hope that you can find some messages in these stories, because that's what I got when I first got here. Like, for example, I was at a discussion meeting, and there was a guy that came in, and he was pretty sharp guy, and he said he had a question, and he asked the chairperson, he says, I don't really know if it's really me when I'm drinking or is it really me when I'm sober. And I thought, oh, I wish I would have been able to ask that question. I wanted to be smart like that. And the girl sitting next to him told him, it's real easy to determine. He says, how's that? Which one do you like the best? And I'm here tonight to tell you, I like myself better sober. And I hope that you like yourself better sober. Because they told me if I didn't like myself better sober, don't let the door hit you in the fanny. I came in at a time when I had a hard time identifying with some of the people at the meeting with their drunkalogs. They were talking about drinking canned heat, men in shaving lotion, tapping radiators. And so I had a difficult time with that. And I was able to adjust a little bit at a time. I didn't really get into the steps right away, which I wish I would have, but I didn't. My program was basically going to meetings, doing what I'm supposed to be doing at the time I'm supposed to be doing it, taking care of the family, going to work, and praying. And I got a home group. And they said, if you continue with this little program that we laid out for you, going to meetings and helping others, the steps will rise to meet you, is what they said. And you look at the four absolutes. And I did that, but I really just did it academically. You know, I didn't take it in. It was just on the outside. And many a times there was people who said some smart things to you at a meeting, you know, like, you know, you're not going to make it. We're taking bets on you and all that. And it kind of got underneath my skin a little bit. And so I thought, well, I'll show them. I'll stay sober anyway, just in spite of it. And I got inspired by listening to people that were talking to other people. I would eavesdrop. And I got a lot of my AA that way. Like, for example, following direction is probably one of the most important things when I came in that you could do. And I was having a difficult time following direction. I can remember being at the Newberg Group in Cleveland, and a young guy came up to one of the old timers, and he asked him, he says, is there anything that you could tell me to help my sobriety? And he says, well, he says, go home and say the third step prayer every night. Get on your knees and say the third step prayer every night. So it was about 2 or 3 weeks later, the kid's back at Newberg Group, and he went up to this guy that told him to do that. He says, hey, he says, I've been doing what you told me. And he says, he didn't remember the kid at all. He didn't know who he was. And he says, don't you remember me? He says, no. He said, well, you told me to go home and say this third step prayer every night. So he said, did you do it? He says, yeah. He says, well, what's the gripe? He says, well, am I supposed to be getting something out of it? He says, well, how the heck do I know? I just want to see if you follow direction. And that's the point. Following direction is so important. You come in here with beat up or whatever, but then when I get sober a little bit, I got an ego problem, pride problem. I don't need to listen to anybody. And you know, for many times I went to a lot of the 12-step weekends. And one of the things that I heard one of the speakers say tonight, today, was that one alcoholic helping another is really important. And there was a lady that came in to speak, and she was like in her 80s. And I was a young guy. I'm thinking, what does old gal have to say to me? What am I going to get out of it? And she talked about when she was drinking, she backed out of her driveway, and there was a big oak tree there. And she hit that tree, took all the bark off of it when she tried to go up to get her booze at the package store. And she says after coming into AA, she says she was sober for a while, and she was sitting on her steps one summer night, and she looked out at that tree, and she says, I made amends to that tree. And there must have been 80 people in that room, and all of them laughed but me. I'm wondering, what is she talking about? And then she said, only in Alcoholics Anonymous could you understand that. One alcoholic to another. It was a long time it took me because I got stuck on stupid. I don't know if anybody can identify with that. This getting stuck on stupid is really, really terrible. And you know, I started drinking, I don't know when, early. But I can tell you when I bought my first bottle. It was 1949. It was the summer of 49. And I was in the park in Cleveland with two of my school buddies, which they were about a year or two ahead of me. And they said, we're going to get some wine. I said, how are you going to do it? They said, well, we know that you are a wine runner for your mom. Because my mom always had me go up to this corner and buy her wine, write a note. So they said, we're going to write a note, and you're going up to get her wine for us. I said, okay. So we got two bottles of Muscatel wine. I don't know if some of you know what Muscatel wine is, but it would take the varnish off this desk right here. And, of course, my one buddy got real sick. Dickie got real sick. And Walter and I took him home and dropped him off on his back porch. And Walter and I decided we'd meet up later in the afternoon and go to the show. Well, Walter's dad caught up with us. And he grabbed us by the neck, took us up to Dickie's house. And he wanted to know where we got the alcohol. And the long and short of it is, I told him that we wrote a note and I got it up at the corner. So they had me write another note, or they wrote another note, and had me go up there, and they busted the guy. He lost his license. We went to court. We got put on probation. And all three of our dads were members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they beat our butt and took us to an AA meeting. Now, that should have been the end of my story, right there. But you know, it wasn't. And I'm a believer that I could take you through some different phases of my drinking. I've been in jail. I did some outdoor living. You know, I did a lot of things that I'm ashamed of. That alcohol, when I started to drink, I wanted to drink. And that's all I did then, until I either passed out, got drunk, or the police picked me up. And I had a lot of interventions with the police. You know, I don't know if anybody, I used to, when I would lead in front of people that I could see mostly, I'd ask, is anybody, please raise your hand if you've ever been in a police car before, you know? And how many people have peed your pants before? How many people have been to jail before? And we could end it right there. That's part of the drinking life. But you know what was more important, that was damaging, was my drinking sent people to therapy. My wife at the time, my kids at the time, and I had a bunch of kids at that time. Before I come into AA, I had 7 kids. I had 6 sons and 1 girl. Okay, and after I got sober, I had 3 more boys. So I figured it out by the time I hit 10. And I did a lot of damage to the family. I wasn't a good father, you know, and in the latter part of my drinking, when I came to AA, I looked like a 6-foot piece of rope with a knot tied in the middle of it with busted glasses. And that was my identity at the bar. Give the guy with the busted glasses another drink. Okay? And in 1969, I was in bad shape. And I was out of work. And my wife was filing for a divorce. She was pregnant, like she was always pregnant most of the marriage. And I went out drinking, and she called me, and I was at the bar. You ever at the bar when they say, you know, the answer? Finally, the barmaid hands the phone to me, and I say, yeah. She says, you're drinking. I said, how do you know? I'm at the bar, you know. And she says, my water broke. She says, I want you to come up to the hospital. And I said, I'll be right there. And I had all the right intentions, but I had to finish the drink. And the next thing I knew, I woke up in jail. Couldn't remember anything, had those blackouts. And a bailiff come to get me out of the jail to take me up to the courthouse. And he says, the judge has got something really nice for you today to talk to you about. I thought, well, what the hell's all this about? I got up there, and he leans over the bench, and he looks down at me, and he says, you know what the definition of a father is? I says, I think so. He says, well, you're not it. He says, your wife gave birth to a kid about 2 days ago. What do you got to say about that? Well, I knew better. I've been in courts before. You just keep your mouth shut. But that's the way my life was running. To tell you that it was just chaos. And that summer, I wound up in Rosary Hall in Cleveland, which is drying out place. And but at that time, Sister Ignatius was gone. Sister Victorine was there. And I knew Sister Ignatius real well. So I come out of there and I start drinking again. And I kept drinking until November of 69. And I got one of those police rides again. I seem to be always getting a ride from the police. And this time they didn't take me to jail. They brought me home. And the reason they did that was because I had a brother that was, an older brother that was a police officer, and they were doing him a favor. And they threw me off at the side door of my house. And I went in the side door of my house, and I made a left instead of a right. That's the way I was always doing. I was always going the wrong way. And the left was go to the basement, and I missed the first step. And you know what happens when you miss the first step? The rest are a real bitch. And I hit the bottom of that concrete. And I'm laying down there, and I had blood coming out of all ends. And my wife at the time, like I said, had filed for divorce. And she was going to Al-Anon. She had been going to Al-Anon for a year or so. And she'd opened up that door, Now and then she'd holler down, "Have you had enough yet?" And I thought, if I could get up off this floor, I'll kill you. And you know, I knew I was done. I was cooked. I wasn't caught. I hit the bottom, literally hit the bottom. I was done. And I asked for help. And the guy that made the 12-step call on me back in 69, he had probably 25 years or so. And he was the greatest, nicest guy I could have ever asked for. And they became your sponsor. You didn't have a choice. You didn't have to say, well, I just got out of treatment and I'm through the fifth step already and I'm looking for a sponsor and I've been sober 6 months. No, that didn't work that way. And, you know, I started my journey in AA, and I'll tell you what, as one of the other speakers or a couple of them said, life still happens when you're sober. You still got speed bumps, a lot of speed bumps. But you know what? I'll tell you what, with all the speed bumps I had in my life since I've been sober, I'd rather be sober. I'd rather be sober and handle the things I had to handle. You know, I used to hear guys say at the meeting, when I was drinking, my kids used to get F's in school. And I thought, well, I've been sober 6 months. My kids are still getting F's. What the hell's going on here? You know, and the neighbor would never talk to me, you know. And I started going to meetings, and like I said, and I hear these guys talking about men and shaving lotion and drinking that, and I didn't identify with that. And then I really cleaning ashtrays, you know. Some people say that's therapeutic. Well, they don't smoke anymore, so I think they still maybe should bring the ashtrays back so we can clean them or something. I don't know. But I really believe that all the help that the people were there in those meetings was trying to give me. My dad stayed away from me. He knew it was a red flag. He stayed away from me. And, you know, I think back now of all the people that have come and gone in my sobriety. My heart aches sometimes because I was a real idiot to them, you know, and all they were was trying to reach out. I can remember when I go to the meeting or something and I'd come home and my ex-wife used to say, well, how was it? I said, you know what this SOB did? He said, what? He came up and shook my hand. He says, how you doing? That's all he said, you know. I just couldn't get next to anybody. And when they'd ask people to read, I would go to the restrooms and hide because I couldn't stay. I couldn't put attention to anything. I couldn't read the newspapers when I got here, you know. And so it took a while, physically, mentally, and spiritually, you know. And they called it an illness, not a disease. I like that better, illness, better than the disease. But anyway, I went along, and I wasn't really, I was on the fringes. I was okay, but I just figured I was going to stick around long enough to get the lights back on and get things peaceful in the house. Well, I was sober about 6 months, and it was in June the 5th. And somebody comes knocking at the door, and I open up the door, and there's this cop standing there. He says, we want to talk to you. And I says, I'm sober. He says, we know you're sober. See, we want you to come with us. So I got in the car, went with them for around the corner where I lived, and there was a lot of commotion, people around there, and I went in the backyard there. There was a swimming pool, a lot of people around, and he pulled his blanket back, and he says, can you identify this body? And I said, yeah, that was my 7-year-old son. Somebody pushed him in the swimming pool, and he drowned. He was 7 years old, and I was 6 months sober, and I'm thinking, oh, I had a resentment against God. I'll tell you what, I had a bigger resentment against God. I had a big resentment against AA. For all I heard was they kept saying, it's going to get better. You're going to get better. They didn't say, they said, I heard it saying, it's going to get better. And that's not what it was. It didn't get better. I was angry. I was resentful. I was mad. And you know, they were taking bets on me to drink. And you know, like I said, I stayed stuck on stupid for a good long time. I didn't think of my wife at the time. I didn't think of my kids at the time. You see, I had AA out here, but I didn't have AA in here. It's better to say, I'm not an AA. AA is in me. That's where it works, just like somebody said today. it's better to say AA is in you. And you know, I didn't. I just had it on the surface. And I went around and I was mean and I was angry and I was angry. And after certain meetings, I would come home. I would stop at the package store and buy a bottle of wine. And I'd get home and I'd set it on the table and I wanted to drink it. And I keep staring, looking at it. I wanted to drink it real bad. I wanted to self-destruct. And my wife at the time would come by and she said, "Why don't you drink it?" I said, "Why do you say that?" She says, "Well, you were a drunken SOB. Now all you are is a sober SOB. You just changed your breath. That's all you did." And she was right. She was right. But by the grace of God, I didn't pick up the drink. But I was miserable. And you know, it was a guy that said, or somebody said in the book or whatever, you know, the truth will free you. I didn't think much about it. But one day, I heard the truth. But they didn't say it would be painless. I heard the truth. I was at an AA meeting. And it was in a hospital, discussion a little bit. And it was a moderator and four or five guys in pajamas. And the guy had his topic. And I come in, and I'm the other only guy outside, come in. And the guy had the topic, but there was one guy in pajamas that kept wanting to interrupt. And he was red in the face. He says, "I want to talk." And the moderator says, "Just take it easy. You'll get your turn." And I see this guy, he's getting angry. So finally, the guy says, "Go ahead. What do you got to say?" He says, "Well, I was sober 7 years." He says, "And you know what happened?" He says, "I went to an AA meeting. I come home one night. And I come home to tell my wife how great the AA meeting was." And she said, she's sitting across from me, and I'm sitting on the couch, and she reaches down underneath the chair, pulls his gun up, puts it to her temple, blows her brains out. And this guy's, he's bulging, his veins are bulging, and there's guys in pajamas that are sliding back away from him. And I'm sitting there getting closer to the guy, because I felt that way on the inside, the way he looked on the outside. And I want to know what the moderator is going to tell him. Easy does it. First things first. He's going to get knocked. And the guy says, "You know what, buddy? I got to tell you one thing since I've been in AA, what I've learned." And he says, "That act, that very act that your wife took her life did not take your choice away." He freed me that day. Losing a kid doesn't take your choice away. Losing whatever. I take my choice away. I have to take my responsibility of my sobriety. I can go out of here tonight and drink a barrel of it if I want to, but I can't do it and be responsible. I love this way of life, but it was painful when I heard that, and I knew he was right. That was the day my sobriety started. That was the day that I really inherited some little piece of AA inside of me. I thought God was punishing me for all the things that I'd done in the past. And life goes on. I start getting better. What do you know? Every day's like Christmas, right? No speeding tickets. Don't have to go to court no more. The only thing that I got screwed up on, I'll tell you how great a guy is that's got 50 years of sobriety. I went off one day to this guy's office, and I had to make a call on him. And I asked him to use the bathroom. He says, "Yeah, right in there." And he's sitting in there and he says, "Hey, what's going on, man?" I says, "You won't believe this." I said, "What?" I says, "I put my underwear on backwards today." So it doesn't matter how long you're sober, I can still make mistakes. And maybe the simplest, funniest ones, but sometimes bad ones. Because I remember a guy that asked my dad, he says, "Don, what do you attribute all your problems to?" "Bad decisions. Bad decisions." And I've made a lot of bad decisions. But one of the best decisions that I ever made was coming to Alcoholics Anonymous and starting to get involved in the steps, starting to get involved in my group and helping others, starting to get back with believing in a higher power that could heal me from the inside out. You know, I like what somebody said one time. There was a hotshot salesman. Pretty smart guy. He's going down this road, dirt road, and he gets lost. He don't know where he's at now. But he sees a guy in a tractor, and he waves him over. The guy, the farmer on the tractor, comes over, and he says, "What's up?" He says, "What's the name of this road?" He says, "I don't know." He says, well, where's the closest town? He says, I don't know. He says, you don't know very much, do you? He says, yeah, but I'm not lost. And I'm not lost today. I know where I'm at. I'm sitting right here in my home with my beautiful wife, talking to people, and hopefully that they understand and they get a message. If you don't, I'm sure there's going to be other people that will be talking and will get a message. And certainly I got a good, beautiful messages from a lot of the people that have already talked. But, you know, life moves on. I got a divorce after 37 years. I found myself with just my car, you know, and 25 years sober. And knowing what I'm going to do, I'm 57 years old. And, you know, I started to date this girl in AA, and she only had 3 months of sobriety. And I had the AA police after me. I was in the AA cassette. We got married, and we had a relationship until she passed away in 2015. You know, a lot of other things have happened in my life, and a lot of people that I'm so grateful that I would have never met had I never come to Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, I read the book in the mornings. My wife and I both read books in the mornings. We pray. She's in Alcoholics Anonymous, my new wife. We got married here in 2017. And it's a beautiful life. I couldn't have ever thought that this would happen to me. And you know, I told you I had a bunch of kids. And I can tell you stories. Oh my God. My one son will celebrate 35 years on the 19th of June. 35 years. He came in when he was 20. And my other son's got 20 years. It took him 20 almost to get 20 years. And my daughter, my only daughter, she had 7.5 years. In 1987, she had 7.5 years. And I remember the day that she came to the house, and she says, Dad, they asked me to leave at the treatment center. I said, oh, good, go out there. And she says, what are you doing? I says, well, she says, I don't want to know what you're thinking. I want to know what you're doing. She was sharp. That was the last day I saw her. She was 26 years old. She went to the AA meeting, and she said a serenity prayer and dropped over dead at 26. She had 3 beautiful kids and a husband, but she had 7.5 years of sobriety. You know, I totally, totally was a different person when she passed away. I was there for the wife. I was there for my kids. I was there to make the arrangements because of Alcoholics Anonymous, because of a program that reached out and touched me so heavenly and divine. It's unimaginable. And I'd be so grateful that if this things happen, I'm so glad to be sober when they are happening. You know, my wife and I parted ways, like I said, and I got remarried again. And then this second wife, she died in 15. And I thought, well, you know, I'm going to AA meetings and be a loner. But then I ran into a gal at an AA meeting. Where else, right? Nice gal. I asked her if she wanted to have coffee. And she said, yeah. She says, I asked her for a number. She says, I'm in the book. I said, well, there are a lot of people in the book. But I found her number. And we started dating. We got married at 17. And we have a beautiful life, a real beautiful life. You know, I can't sometimes believe of all the things that's happened in my life, and I'm still here today to share a little bit with somebody that maybe I can give some hope to, or you know, or you can find some strength in some of my talks or whatever. But I know that there's a story that I like to tell, like where would alcoholics be without our stories, right? It goes like this. There was a guy that was madly in love. This guy was young, so was his girlfriend. And one night, he knelt down and proposed to her. And when he was proposing to her, he looked over and there was some marbles close by. And he picks up the marbles and he holds them up to her and says, I wish they were rubies. 45 years later, this guy's a famous playwright. She's an actress, but she's dying of cancer. And he's at her bedside. And he's talking to her about their life and how much he loved her. And he looks over on the nightstand and he sees some rubies. He grabs the rubies and he holds them up to her and he says, I wish they were marbles. It goes quick. Don't waste it. I want to be present to the moment. And I'll tell you what's really some sober experiences that are so valuable to me. I've chaired, been to meetings outside the country, all over. That's great. That's nice. But you know what's really valuable in my sobriety? Being present to the moment, where I missed a lot of this. I got a little nephew. At the time, he was about 8 years old. And I come over to the house and his mother said, your uncle's got an anniversary. And he immediately went over to the dining room table and scratched out on a piece of paper. He says, Uncle Bob, I love you as much as possible. What's that word? That's what a highlight for me is. When a little kid can tell me he loves me as much as possible. You know, I grew up with alcoholic father and mother. And I ain't here to tell you about taking their inventory. But it was a tough life, you know. And when I used to hear people say at the meetings that their parents did the best they could, I'd say my head would go and say, my parents didn't do the best they could. But you know what? I love them anyway, because I have kids and I'm an alcoholic practicing it one time, now sober, and I didn't do the best I could and they love me. So why shouldn't I love my parents? You know? But you know, life is great. It's beautiful. Sober is better. Together is better. But you know, there's three things that one of the speakers talked about this too. There's three things the guy told me if you want to be pretty successful with this sobriety in life. I said, what's that? He says, number one, be kind. Number two, be kind. Number three, be kind. And I try to work on that. You know, when I came in, somebody didn't take me through the book or the steps right away. They said, John's going to be working your first step with you, and Bill's going to work your third and fourth step with you. They passed you now. Not everybody knew anything. I don't know everything about the big book. I don't know the best guy to take you through the steps, but I do know what I'm good at, and that's what I'm going to give you. And if I don't know, we can find out together, because that's what this program is. It's a we program. It's together we can do it. Okay? Together. I can't do anything without my higher power or you this program or you people like in these rooms. I feel very humbled to be asked. I know that, you know, I remember when you get asked to lead an anniversary somewhere, and I got asked and I went to the anniversary guy, says, oh, there's a few people. There was like 90 or 100 people there. They had all the food laid out on the side. And they did a smart thing, though. The lead talked first, and then they ate. Because every time they looked at you, they were looking at the food. They looked at you, they looked at the food. So you knew it was time, cut it off, you know. But it really impressed me that I'd never been to that meeting before. And I probably more likely wouldn't be back unless I was asked to leave. But I figured out, there were so many people in that room that was more befitting to be the lead for that anniversary than me, just like tonight. This is AA's anniversary of 85 years. There's so many more people that are more qualified to be up here talking than me. I'm just a small peg in the wheel, just a small peg. I'm not anything special. And that's what I generally try to do and tell my kids over the years. I'd get my kid to call me, and I'd get on the phone, and they'd say, what are you doing? I said, I'm trying to be a 5. They said, what do you mean? I says, well, not a 10, not a 0. just five average guy going through this life trying to be relatively happy. Leave me alone. You know, I'm just a regular guy. I'm not anything special. I just want to go through this life and enjoy it and be able to help somebody, but mostly to help myself and my family and anybody else that I can do, whether in AA or out of AA. Okay? You know, I mean, I was the type of guy that you cut me off, I'd chase up with you and I'd get a gun and I'd point the gun at you, run you off the road. You know? Now today, since I got a little smarter in AA, guy cuts me off or I cut him off and he's keeping on side of me, you know, he's giving me the hand signal, especially that one finger, and I'm trying to get away from him, he won't leave. So, man, I've heard the other people in AA do this. So I go like this, I motion, pull over. Ah, this guy, okay. So he zooms up, pulls over, and I go right on by. Well, see you later. You got to get smarter. And that's what I did. I got a little smarter in doing things a lot easier on myself instead of making it hard. You know, I'm a believer that, you know, I was afforded school and good things to come by and everything, but I was a guy, a street guy. I was a street guy. I see people, they're educated, but like my friend Walter had just passed away. He used to say he was educated above his intelligence, you know. And I'm a believer that AA is simple. It's really simple. When you come into the West Side and you come to the treatment center or halfway house, they ask you one thing. You want crap or you want ice cream? This is ice cream. This is a good life. This is a good life. But you know what? I got to be able to exercise it. I got to be able to do something with it. I just can't hold it on to myself. Because we're just keeping it in. It's going to die. It's going to die. It's got to have an outlet. And I have an outlet. Not just in meetings, but everywhere in my life, with my family, with my wife. I have an outlet. And I am grateful for that. I've been blessed. I've been really blessed. And you know, I want to mention, my kids are a big part of my life, of course, having 10 kids, and I lost my daughter and my one little boy. I had, somebody used to say, there's examples in these rooms, there's just examples after example. But let me tell you what, there was an example in my own family, and I missed it. I missed it. It was one of my sons. I missed it. I was active in AA, and he was a good example. I was looking for examples in the room, which there is, okay? This kid went to a little parochial school. He flunked. They held him back. He never bridged. They flunked again, held him back, didn't say nothing, kept flunking. I thought he'd never get out of grade school. Finally got to high school, and they held him back, and they held him back. So one summer he comes to me at the end of the season of school, and he says, I want to graduate. And I says, well, everybody wants you to graduate, Tom. And he says, I got a plan. Like you and AA, we got a plan. And I said, what is it? He says, I'm going to summer school. I said, that's great. Go. He got his diploma. He went to summer school and he graduated. I mean, it's good. And at the end of that, I mean, I was so proud of him. It was so hard for him to learn. Okay. Then that September, he comes to me and he says, I want to go down to the college. Kent State. And I says, oh, I don't know about that. He says, I want to go. So he went down there. And I figured, well, they'll look at his GPA. You know, some people blew it higher in a breathalyzer than his GPA was. And they told him, they says, maybe you ought to go to the branch, kid. And he says, no, the law says I got a high school diploma. I can come to college. And he signed his own name to these loans after loans. And he went to Kent. He went to Kent. He went to Kent. He went to Kent. I thought, hey, he's liking it. Who cares? You know. And he got a job down there. I got letters from professors who said, they never seen somebody that wanted to learn so bad, that had such a hard time but kept coming back. Like in AA. We have those, don't we? They keep coming back. They keep coming back. Just keep coming back. You got to be persistent. And he was. And he graduated from Kent State University. I thought, oh, my God. I got one that I never thought he'd get out of grade school. He graduated from high school. And then he got right in high school. He went to college. He graduated from college. Because he persisted. He kept hanging in there. And he was such an example. And you know, the year went by and he got a little sales job. And he told his brothers, he says, I want to go to the seminary. I want to be a priest. His brother says, you know what that means, don't you? He says, what? He ain't gonna be going out with any girls. He says, that's all right. He became a priest, became a Benedictine monk down in Latrobe, Pennsylvania, a guy I never thought would get out of grade school. What an example, and I missed this. This kid was such driving force to learn and to want a better life, and he got a better life. He became a monk down in Latrobe, Pennsylvania, Arnold Palmer's country, right? Anyway, in the year 2000, I get a call from my other son. He says, my son that went to the monastery took the name of Brother Anthony. And he says, Dad, my son Tommy was his original name. He said he got up in front of a community of monks to talk. He loved the community. He loved it, you know. And he sat down in a chair and he fell off the chair and died at 31 years of age. And, you know, there it is again, another tragedy. And somebody used to say, tragedies happen to everybody. Drunk or sober, these things could happen. But the tragedy is if you stay in the tragedy. And I heard that, but it didn't feel good. It still today doesn't feel good. But I remember at the time I'm divorced, I go down to the monastery and bury him, and I'm standing right next to his coffin, looking down. He's 31 years old. He looked better than the guys and the monks standing around me. They were 80 and 90. And I said to the monk, I says, look at this. I don't get it. He says, what don't you get? I says, he's only 31. I says, how old are you? He says, he was 89 or something. He says, yeah, but he put it together in 31 years. He says, we're still putting it together. Isn't that all we're doing tonight? Putting a little more together. We're all putting a little more together. We're going to get on that bus. And you know what? I know that group one's coming. I got a lot of my friends in group one. And I know that I'm not anxious to get there, but I know I'll be looking forward to seeing them all. He put it together in 31 years. I'm still putting it together, and I'm 80-some years old. And I'm not ashamed to tell you that I tried to grow up very hard, and I grew up real hard under the influence of alcohol, and I couldn't do it. It beat me up. But I'm not ashamed to tell you tonight that I'm still trying to grow up, but under the influence of a higher power, these 12 steps, these principles, the four absolutes, and people like yourself. I love this program. I really do. I can't say enough to tell you how much I love this program. And, you know, life goes on. And my wife and I today, we have a beautiful home. We have life together. We have AA together. We have a higher power together. And I sometimes think, I don't know, something's wrong. I'm still haunted by some of the things that maybe I don't deserve it. You know, I got that feeling like, you know, I didn't do everything right when I was drinking, and I didn't do everything right since I've been sober. But you know what? I'm going to take what's given to me, good or bad. See, because if I blame God for the bad stuff, the good stuff, I got to blame Him for the bad stuff. And I don't blame Him for anything. I'm the one that made decisions and choices that caused me the pain and others. You know, I want to thank everybody that spoke before me. I wish I could talk the way they did, but it wouldn't be me. I got to just be me. You know, it's like the guy said, I'm Popeye the Sailor Man. That's all I am, Popeye the Sailor Man. I'm going to be the best that I can be. It's not like Sailor Man, you know. And I'm going to go on with my life and be sober with my wife and my kids and my grandkids. You know, when the day comes that when my time comes to pass this life, I want to be recognized as a good AA, like my dad said. I want to be remembered as a good AA. I want to always be able to reach out to help anybody that's in need of help, whether sober or not, you know. And I'd like to close, and I know that we said this already, and I just, love and tolerance is our code. Love and tolerance is our code, okay? I want to read this because this sums it all up for me, and it sums it up for a lot of people. And, you know, I just want to read the preamble again, so just bear with me, would you? Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other. that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is the desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We're self-supported through our own contribution. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. It does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. God bless everyone. Thank you for listening, and good night.